Hey everybody, welcome to episode number 95 of Toeing the Slab, Pitching with David Cone. It is Pitching Talk each and every week. We do it with the five-time World Series champ, the former Cy Young Award winner, David Cone. We have the research ace, James Smythe, fresh off the jet from London. Our fantastic producer, Dan Rourke, is with us as well. We, within this episode, the time frame of this episode, we've approached the midway point of the 2023 season. Kind of hard to believe. And a lot of things are upside down. Not a lot that we predicted has happened so far, but there are some things that have gone the way we maybe envisioned. I think at the top of that list, gentlemen, Shohei Ohtani is still Shohei Ohtani, and he continues to dominate. We'll get to him in a few moments, though. But how are you guys doing?
Doing great. You know, it's I'm with it. You know, I kind of feel excited. You know, this is a great time of the year. College World Series just finished. The Major League Baseball draft is coming up, the midway point, and then the trade deadline. So, yeah, everything's kind of – this is the time of year where everybody's taking inventory and kind of figuring out, you know, what comes next.
Yeah, and with basketball and hockey ending a couple weeks ago, now it's baseball fully on display here. It's all about baseball here in the States.
We got a lot to pack into this episode. We're talking about obviously some current topics that are going on as we approach the midway point and the trade deadline, roughly a month away now. We will be talking with Mark Mulder from the Oakland A's, from the St. Louis Cardinals, a decorated big league career for Mark Mulder. He is also a fantastic golfer, and he's playing in the most celebrated celebrity tournament next month in South Lake Tahoe, California. But we're going to be talking with Mark just about his pitching story, some of the teams he was on, especially that Moneyball A's era, a terrific time in Oakland. And speaking of Oakland, well, that's where I'm at right now with the New York Yankees, and they did not look too sharp in their series opener on Tuesday night. The offense continues to be a problem, so we'll talk about the Yankees as well. But let's start with the opener, guys. David, what do you have for us this week?
Well, I think it's a good time to talk about international baseball with the, you know, the London series over the last weekend. It was pretty interesting to watch the fanfare, what's coming next, potentially Paris in a couple of years as well. Is this viable? Is international baseball viable? I think it's been a smashing success in London. And I know, James, you were just there as part of the Sunday Night Baseball crew with Alex and Michael. And, you know, maybe I'll defer to you and get your impressions on how it went over there.
It was great. And the atmosphere was fantastic. There were about 55,000 fans for both games at London Stadium. And it was so much fun to, I mean, yeah, you see, you know, two teams playing in a different setting and everything, but the fans, you had Cubs and Cardinals fans, everyone, it was just a very good mood all around, everyone in town for these games. You have, whether it's expats or people who are Cubs or Cardinals fans traveling to the game. What I also loved seeing was all the people representing their own teams. Over the weekend in London, I saw jerseys, hats, any kind of team gear representing 29 of the 30 MLB teams. People wearing Mariners caps and Astros jerseys and Dodgers stuff and Diamondbacks. Oh, there's a Padres. Check them off the list. Saw 29 of the 30 teams represented, but not the Rockies. No Rockies gear. Saw NC Dinos from the KBO represented. No Rockies. Saw the Lansing Lugnuts from the minors in the Midwest League. No Rockies gear. Even the Savannah Bananas. So Savannah Bananas jersey, but no Rockies gear. Maybe somebody had it packed for Sunday's game, and then when they saw it was 25-1 back home, they said, you know, maybe better wear something else.
Step it up, Rockies. That game actually happened against the Angels. We're going to touch on them in a few moments. What was like the coolest event that maybe you experienced that didn't have anything to do with, you know, the actual games taking place inside the stadium?
Well, I mean, for me personally, the day after the last game on Monday, I went to see Stonehenge, which was really cool outside of the city. But just as far as the atmosphere around the game, there were all kinds of, you know, fan fest type of stuff that you would see back home for maybe like an all-star game or something like that, which is cool. But I'm going to flip it around because at the end of the day, the coolest part was eventually like seeing the teams. It was postseason style intros and them lined up on the bases with the big American and British flags lined up, and then that's when it starts to hit you. Oh, all this fanfare is based around this game that we all love. And it was just a really great experience.
Nice. And going to keep going, obviously. Mets, Phillies, slated to go next season.
Right. The Paris 25, yeah. And then London again in 2026. So you have each of the next three seasons after this, when you have at least one of these international showcase type games lined up. So it's really great. And I think another big thing, too, is coming off the heels of the WBC, which was a smashing success, as Coney said with this, too. So I think international baseball is on the rise.
They include Mexico City in that as well. So, yeah, it is interesting to see baseball try to go international. And, you know, with the success in London, we'll it's a good follow. It's something that's obviously a chance to grow the game. And I think we're all fans of that because we all love the game. We want to see it thrive and do well.
Dude, London again next year. Hearing whispers that it could be Yankees, Red Sox in Paris in 2025. Obviously, we'll be on the lookout for that.
People, more Tone the Slab is coming up. But first, I need to tell you about how you can hit it out of the park this baseball season with DraftKings Sportsbook. New customers can place a $5 bet and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. Plus, all customers can take a shot at bigger payouts with DraftKings stepped-up same-game parlays. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app, sign up with code SLAB, that's S-L-A-B, and new customers can bet just $5 and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. That's code SLAB only at DraftKings Sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. In Massachusetts, call 800-327-5050 or visit gamblinghelplinema.org. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY. In Kansas, call 1-800-522-4700. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort, 21 or plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for details and state-specific responsible gaming resources. Bonus bets expire 7 days after issuance. Opt-in and 10-plus leg requirement for 100% boost. Eligibility, wagering, and deposit restrictions apply. Terms at sportsbook.draftkings.com/baseball terms.
All right, let's get to some action happening back here in the States. You mentioned the Rockies. The Angels crushed the Rockies in that one game over the weekend. And on Tuesday night, Shohei Ohtani at it again, essentially coming up with the victory himself. On the mound, he fans 10 at the plate. He homers twice in a victory for the Angels over the White Sox. I'm wondering here, how would you describe the Angels' current position with Shohei Ohtani, with everything we know, again, slated to hit free agency, with roughly 1 month to go until the trade deadline and the position they are in right now in that wild card race?
I think they always intended to hold on to him no matter what. I actually talked to Perry Mathiasen who's always been very firm on this. We're not trading Shohei Ohtani. There's no way they're going to trade him. They are in it. They are for real. They have a chance to really kind of finally break through and get to postseason play. And if they do, and they have success in the postseason, that's going to influence Ohtani's decision-making to potentially stay with Anaheim. Now, I'm not sure what kind of offer he's going to command. It's going to break the bank. It's going to be a trailblazing type of deal that we've never seen before in baseball, and rightly so. I mean, he is the unicorn. He's a different cat. There's nobody like him. There's no comps. There's always a comp, right? There's always, well, he's kind of like this, you know, a pitcher that's a free agent. Well, he's kind of like this guy who got this contract. There's always a list of comps. There are no lists. There's zero on the comp list for Shohei Ohtani. There really isn't. Maybe if you break it down into two categories, he's kind of like this hitter or kind of like this pitcher, and then you double it up. I jokingly say that maybe the Angels, maybe Artie Moreno, who's now going to stay the owner of the Angels after sort of toying with the idea of selling the franchise, maybe offer him equity. You know, it's kind of a joke. You know, the Kansas City Royals did that way back in the day one time, offering, you know, equity positions or lifetime, sort of a lifetime membership, so to speak, you know, or a lifetime contract. That's kind of what we're looking at in terms of the creative side with Shohei Ohtani. If the A's want to compete, if the Dodgers are in it, if the Yankees are in it, or the Red Sox are in it, who knows if the Mets are in it, it's going to be an interesting follow to see what happens with Shohei Ohtani. But the Angels' best position is to try to win with him and keep him. So I believe Perry when he says There's no way they're going to trade Shohei Ohtani, even though that kind of trade would be something to put together, right? What he could command back, even as a rental, that would be something to see, but it's not going to happen.
You got to ride it out with Shohei. And if you're looking at, you know, end of June here, going into the season, this is probably about as well as it's gone as well as you could have hoped if you're the Angels. The default position in the American League West for the last several years is that the Astros are going to go run away and hide. They have not. The Rangers have kind of ascended, and they're up by five games, but that is by no means an insurmountable deficit, and they're holding a playoff spot. So things have gone about as well as you could have hoped for the Angels, and Ohtani is obviously at the forefront of that, but you are in a position finally. Maybe we've been talking ourselves into this for so many years. Is this the year that Trout can get back to the playoffs, that Ohtani can reach the postseason for the first time? And you look at the landscape in the wild card race, you can go with, as long as Ohtani is doing his thing, they can go as far as anyone.
I think we still have a month to go to the trade deadline. I'm not fully convinced that if the Angels sputter here, and look, give them a ton of credit, because this is pretty much past the annual point where they start to go on a tailspin. They're doing it. They're winning ball games. They're keeping themselves in this race. It is wide open at the moment. They can continue to get better, but I also wouldn't be surprised if they go out and, you know, maybe lose 12 out of 13 or 14 out of 15. Like, it would be very Angels-like for that to happen. We've seen it in the past. So I think the jury's still out. I think you still use this full month. If they're in a similar position they are now, say a month from now, obviously you're holding on to Ohtani. Obviously you're making a big run for it, and you're obviously probably adding. But I think there's still a lot to figure out over the next month. I'm not fully convinced that they're going to keep Ohtani if things go a bit south here. And with the Angels, you kind of have to hold your breath and make sure that things don't go south. So we'll see what happens there. We have reached the midway point for several teams here, and throughout this week, everyone's going to be hitting that 81 game mark. So kind of thinking pound for pound, who is your all around top pitching staff, guys?
Wow. You know, you really got to stay current, right? With the injuries that tend to manifest themselves on a daily basis. I'm here, but you know, I really believe that Texas is underrated. I think Nathan Eovaldi is a true ace, and he's a leader of that staff. Even without Jacob deGrom, obviously not coming back, I think they're undervalued, underrated there in Texas. You know, as you go around, obviously, you know, when you look at the National League and the Atlanta Braves as well, Spencer Strider kind of hit a little bump in the road recently. He got knocked around a little bit. His ERA kind of jumped up a bit there, but he's still the premier strikeout guy, I think, in the National League right now. So, you know, I still believe the Braves too probably are up there as a contender for that type of pitching staff. So, you know, it's Houston. Framber Valdez is a true ace. He's really stepped up, you know, and Houston overall has had some problems at the back end of their bullpen. Rafael Montero's really struggled after the 3-year deal they gave him, but Houston's still a very good pitching staff overall as well. Hunter Brown is for real. I saw him pitch on Sunday night in LA. He's got a delivery built to last, an easy gassed, really deceptive four seamer. Even though it lights up the radar guns, it looks effortless to me when he throws it. It really jumps out of his hand. So just from the eye test, he looks real to me, and the metrics back it up. So, you know, certainly Hunter Brown's a big X factor with Framber Valdez and, of course, Christian Javier. And so Houston's still a really good pitching staff as well.
With all due respect to the Rays, who are allowing the fewest runs per game in the major leagues, and they lead the majors in rotation ERA at 3.46. Shane McClanahan, maybe I was a year too early on picking him to win the American League Cy Young. We'll see how the last few months go. But going for a little more balance, I'm going to go with the Minnesota Twins, which I never thought I would say for best pitching staff in the game halfway through a season. But what I love about them is that they have the mix of rotation and bullpen. So for the season, they're second to the Rays in runs allowed, but they're fourth in starting pitching ERA and fifth in reliever ERA. So they're the only team in the top five in both. You talk about frontline guys, you have Sonny Gray, Pablo Lopez, even someone like Bailey Ober has come out of nowhere and done really well for them. Joe Ryan, outstanding. And at the end of the game, you have Joan Duran closing it out. Elite, elite combo of missing bats with strikeout, with a high strikeout rate, and getting a gajillion ground balls. Griffin Jacks has done a good job too. So Minnesota, of all teams, is my thinking there.
Coincidentally, statistically, I was going with the Minnesota Twins as well, even though they're a hovering 500 team. So James and I kind of thinking alike there. It's all about balance, right? And they have statistically some of the best balance in the game. But I guess I have to give love, in my opinion, to the Astros. They continue to find ways to just get results despite some of the adversity that they've experienced in their rotation. And it's a reason why I do feel eventually they are going to overtake Texas to take the AL West in the second half. So Houston, I guess, could be my overall pick. But I may be biased here, looking a little bit down the road. The Yankees have been really good in the bullpen. Guys, we know that. We know how good that bullpen has been. And then when you think about the rotation, Gerrit Cole at the top, we have Carlos Rodon, one rehab start away from making his debut. Luis Severino can consistently give what he gave in his last start. That's a pretty formidable top three right there. If the Yankees ever get their offense going, I think they're going to be tough to beat in the second half.
Fair enough. I love Joe Ryan too. Go ahead, James. But I mean, mm-hmm. I love Joe Ryan. So I love that Minnesota pick.
Right. And Shaq, you're right in that the rotation as it looks right now for the Yankees could be, if you talk about a top four, maybe in a playoff push, a playoff series, it could be 75% overturned from what it is now. If you say, if Seve is really back and he turns it around, Nestor Cortez returning from injury, Carlos Rodon returning from injury, you could have a totally different rotation there.
Yeah, totally. I'll have to see if they get any run support. That's the big question. we'll touch on that in a little bit. Right now, let's get to Mark Mulder, two-time All-Star, former 20-game winner, synonymous with the Oakland A's from the Moneyball era, always will be associated with the other two from the big three, Tim Hudson, Barry Zito, and our guest this week on Toe in the Slab, Pitching with David Cone, Mark Mulder. All right, Mark Mulder is with us. He is getting ready for 54 holes in South Lake Tahoe, California, the American Century Championship, beginning in a couple weeks, starting July 14th. And this is the premier celebrity golf tournament that happens annually. Happens for a great cause as well, charities involved. And this is a tournament that, Mark, you've won three times. So who's all playing? Who's the big competition this year?
Well, I mean, it's always Marty Fish, Annika Sorenstam, John Smoltz, Tony Romo, Jeremy Roenick, Derek Lowe. There's a handful of us. I mean, the ones I kind of listed, I think Joe Pavelski, a hockey guy, he's another one. Mm-hmm. He's always kind of up at the top of the leaderboard. And then you got guys like Steph Curry, Justin Timberlake. I mean, you have some huge names that are involved in this tournament. So it's a tournament of who's who, and it's a special time, man. The amount of fans that show up for this tournament, this tournament's kind of become a monster. I mean, it's a destination. It's on the water there in Lake Tahoe, and it's a really cool spot.
No, it every really year is. You get like.
Go ahead, yeah, David, go ahead, Chuck. Yeah, no, I mean, I was just going to say, you know, I got a chance to play in it one year, Mark, and I agree with you completely. I mean, the fans, obviously the par three with the boats along the right side out there, number 17. And yeah, it was nerve wracking for me. I mean, I'm a left-handed 100%. Hacker, you know, with 100%. Teeing off with fans there, you know, worried about shanking one, maybe hitting a fan or just the cheers and the booze that you get if you kind of lay some sod. I laid some sod over a couple shots in front of some fans. It was pretty embarrassing.
Well, I always told people it's a whole different animal playing in something like that, because not only are you – none of us who are playing in this grew up doing this. None of us grew up playing golf at this capacity or anything like that. So it's something you kind of have to learn how to handle, and the amount of adrenaline that you have on those last few holes, just with all those people, the nervous energy. The first hole every year, I swear, I tee the ball up and my hand is shaking. I mean, I just pray the ball stays on the tee box or stays on the tee, because I don't want to have to try and set it on there again with my hand shaking. So, you know, it's it's a special time, and it is funny seeing good golfers play in this tournament, and they just they lose it because they can't handle it. And you know, the cameras show up, and some of the thoughts that go through your head have never crossed my mind on a golf course before. And it's like you said, you get to 17 and you're just thinking, what if I hit one off these people on the boats? You know, and the reality is once I realized playing in this tournament that nobody there cares how I hit the golf ball, that's when I finally just let it go and I started to enjoy myself a little more.
Mark, when you're competing in these celebrity tournaments, I mean, like you mentioned, you've won this specific tournament, but I'm sure you're coming across the same celebrities, athletes in other sports on the regular. Is there like that one athlete, that one celebrity who you have the most competition with in these tournaments?
I would probably say Marty Fish, who used to play tennis. Him and I, now Tony's won, Romo's won a bunch these last handful of years. So, I mean, it's the three of us have, I think that if you totaled it up over the last, say, 7-8 years, I would have to say the three of us have won the majority of these things. But Marty and I just have, I have so much fun playing with him. There's always some chirping going on. Someone rolls in a long birdie putt. You know, it's kind of the clubhouse that I miss so much from baseball. There's always comments made. Playing with Roenick is always awesome. It depends. I mean, there's no one that I don't enjoy playing with. Let's put it that way. But there are definitely a few guys, Derek Lowe. There are definitely a few guys that I really enjoy when I get paired with them because I feel like I play better because we're just going to have that much fun together.
So, Mark, we're going to be talking to you about your career, just the craft of pitching altogether, but obviously a decorated career with the A's and the Cardinals. And really, you take a look at your playing time. You were never on a team that was out of a pennant race. And for fans watching the 2023 season, both of those teams are in last place. The A's are in a historic last place position. But we'd be remiss if we didn't just get your reaction because you were so part of great times in Oakland. What was your reaction when it was revealed that the A's received approval for a stadium in Las Vegas?
Well, I'm sad. I'm sad for the big time, the real true fans out there, the ones who came every day. You know, even when I was there, we never drew a ton of fans. But the reality is the ones who did come day in, day out were awesome. I'm disappointed for them. I think you'd have to have your head in the sand if you didn't know that this was coming. And to be fair, when I was in Oakland in the early 2000s, we were supposed to have this stadium in a few years, a new stadium. So, you know, the Bay Area, unfortunately, with the Raiders leaving, the Warriors going across the Bay, that whole East Bay is there's not going to be anything left. And the last time I was at the stadium in Oakland two years ago, I think, maybe a year and a half ago, I mean, the whole area around that stadium is 10 times worse than when I was there. And so why would any family, you can't even take the BART train in anymore. You know, why would a family with kids take their kids to the game? It's not going to happen. It's not safe. The area's awful. Nobody's doing anything about it. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen to that area once the A's are gone, but it's just unfortunate because I do have a love for that area. But I think this is a long time coming. They've tried to do what they can with the stadium. I mean, I know now the new clubhouse, they moved into the Raiders old locker room. It's incredible. Now it's twice the walk from our clubhouse down to the field. Our old locker room is actually their weight room. So, I mean, that tells you just how big it was for us when we were there, but I also didn't know any better. That was my first team. So I really didn't know any better. I thought it was the greatest place ever. So it's sad they're leaving. I hope they can find a way to keep the history. I mean, you look at those 70s teams and the things with those A's back in the day, it was really cool. And yeah, we had some successful years. We didn't we didn't have the success come playoff time, but we had some very memorable teams, I guess. And it is kind of amazing just how many people around the country remember our early 2000 teams. And it's pretty special.
David, what's your lasting player impression as a visitor to the Coliseum?
The same thing, you know, I mean, it's two different stadiums. You know, I'm old enough, you know, I'll date myself here. I'm old enough before they had the suites in center field, right? It was a beautiful ballpark back in the day with the best sound system before they, you know, Al Davis built the monstrosity for the Raiders there in center field. Yeah. It kind of blocked everything off. It was a true baseball park back in the day. And it was beautiful. The ball really carried during the day, whole different ballpark during the daytime than it was at night. You know, obviously the Marine Layer or the coolness comes in the Bay Area at night and the ball doesn't travel as much, but it was a good pitcher's park, a lot of foul territory. I enjoyed pitching there. It was a fun place to pitch. It was, you know, I have some fond memories there too. It was my first game back from my aneurysm where I threw 7 no hit innings and got taken out by Joe Torre after 7 innings. So that was when McGuire was there. So you think about McGuire and you know, Canseco and those type of, you know, Tony La Russa, A's, Dennis Eckersley, Mark's right. There's a lot of history there. And, you know, I guess my thing with Mark is that, you know, today there's a lot of talk about load management. Pitchers get to 100 pitches, they're out of the game. You had some monster years early in your career. You were in the big leagues at 22 years old. You had like 4 or 5, 200 inning plus years before we were 26 years old or something in that range. So do you, with the benefit of hindsight, do you look back and think, man, that was a little too heavy of a workload for a young kid, you know, that didn't have a lot of time in the minor leagues? Or do you feel like that, you know, maybe the guys today are a little baby?
No, I don't think it was too much. In fact, at that time I wanted more. Every game I started, I wanted to finish. And I don't blame the pitchers today in a way, because I feel like they're taught in the minor leagues, 5 innings. Hey, great job, kid. You know, it's what they're being taught, and it's how they're coming up in the minors, and they're being told 5-6 innings. The last couple of years I was doing TV, I was doing one of the A's games, and I'm the kid for the A's was dealing, and he goes out for the 7th inning, and he keeps looking back to the bullpen. You know, and he's given up 1 run through 7 innings, has like 90 pitches. And I couldn't believe he was looking back going, guys going to get somebody up, you know? And it's just amazing to me. I think what last year was Alcantara. I think he was the only one who had 200 innings, maybe. The 200 innings is going to be gone here soon. And, you know, at what point are these owners going to go, hey, what are we paying this starting pitcher $30 million for? You know, I mean, is it going to turn into just a team of pitchers instead of starters or relievers? You know, it's weird. It's kind of hard to watch. I enjoy watching baseball when one of the veteran, well, I can't say veteran, but one of the guys who some of these starters who are able to locate, and all of them have such incredible stuff. It's pretty amazing just how good their stuff is. But, you know, there's times you watch a guy, a hitter, the way he reacts to the first 2 pitches, and my thought being an ex-pitcher is I'm sitting there going, well, just don't throw him anything off speed. Just throw him another fastball. Boom, slider, double in the gap. And you're just going, what are you doing? You know, and it doesn't seem as though the pitchers pay attention to how the hitters react to certain pitches. They're looking at, I don't know. They're looking at charts, whatever it is. They're looking at numbers, and these guys have such incredible stuff. And I just don't see the knowledge or the, it's just books or numbers that they're pitching by, as opposed to watching this and paying attention to it. It's just, oh, that guy hits 170 against sliders. Let's throw that. I just threw 2 fastballs by him, but let's throw a slider anyway. And so there's just too many times I watch it. And I don't know, I don't want to sound like this old mad ex-pitcher or anything or whatever, but that's just what I see. And it's kind of frustrating at times.
Well, it's certainly a refrain we hear from a lot of ex-pitchers. Certainly the process is different nowadays. The training for these kids coming up through the minor leagues is different. There's a real emphasis on power. One thing I've noticed too, Mark, I know it's been a few years since you've been a commentator, in television, been connected, but I really think the strike zone has changed a lot. It was more of an east and west strike zone. If you remember, even back when you broke in, if you threw a pitch right down the middle at the mask, that was a ball. But if you threw it if you had good control just off the plate or right on the outside corner, you'd get a little margin there the more consistent you were. And it was more of an east and west strike zone. So I think that's a big deal too, with strikeouts and the style of pitching and more power as opposed to craftsmanship and hitting your spots. Yep. It's more north and south. I think that's an underrated facet of the game. And I know it was probably that way when you first broke in as well.
Yeah, I honestly think in a way I might struggle pitching to this strike zone, because I was just constantly sinker, split, curveball, like everything I threw was down. And when I tried to elevate, I didn't have my four seam fastball still moved like a sinker half the time. So I still had a ton of sink to it. So if I threw something, when I tried, like if I had somebody 0-2 and I tried to elevate a fastball, I would get that emergency hack and they'd hit a base hit to right field. And I would just be going, why did I even try to do that? So for me, I was never able to really pitch up in the zone. It was difficult. And so, like you said, trying to throw at the top part of the zone today and throw the ball by guys, I never really had the ability to do that. So I don't know what I would have done in today's game. It might have been tough for me because they would just look down. And I will say that, like you said, there is no really anything off the plate these days, or on the sides east and west on the plate, that they're giving to these guys. And I see some of those pitches that are called strikes at the top of the zone, and my first thought is, oh, that's a ball. And boom, it's in the strike zone technically, and these umps are pretty good at what they're at their craft. And so the fact that they're able to call these pitches and see it up there. And some of these guys are older. Some of these guys I threw to. So, therefore, they've had to adjust to this new strike zone, which is impressive. I just think it would be tough for me to pitch up in the zone in today's game.
What do you think of the idea of the automated ball strike system, the sort of robot umpire using the strike box to call balls and strikes in games?
I would assume at some point people are going to give in and it's going to go that direction. I personally don't like it. I kind of like the human factor to it. I like the fact that these umpires are the best of the best back there, and they are going to miss pitches. But there's also a certain flow to a game sometimes when that guy's dealing and that pitcher's out there struggling. And, you know, there's it's double-sided. I mean, there are times when I was out there struggling and you did throw a decent pitch that was maybe on the corner and I didn't get the call. And yeah, you're frustrated as a pitcher, but when I look back at that, I guess my thought is always I should have been better. That's the way it goes. But I think today you see a lot of a lot of things have changed. And I think at some point, Major League Baseball will probably go that direction, because slowly people just kind of give in to certain things, I guess.
Mark, growing up in Chicago, pitching at Michigan State, like where and I guess how did you learn and harness control as a young pitcher?
My high school coach, we had some pretty good teams. I mean, we were nationally ranked for a south side of Chicago high school. Our school had about a 6-year,
probably an 8-year run. Probably an 8-year run that, sorry, I got some sort of sound on my phone. Oh, wait, there you go. It's gone. So our high school had about an 8 or 10 year run. So Cliff Floyd went to my high school 4 years before me. When I was in eighth grade, he was a senior. They won the state championship that year. We had numerous guys drafted. My high school coach kind of had the approach, if you can't throw strikes, you don't pitch. So that's kind of how that started for me. And so my
My high school pitching coach was talented. I loved working with him. But for me, it was more at Michigan State. My college pitching coach was a big part of my success, helping me get on to kind of calling in favors, trying to help me get into bigger programs. Good summer teams. I got onto a Connie Mack team in Cincinnati. Then he got me into the Cape Cod League, and that really changed a lot of stuff for me. So that was two people were probably the two that helped me the most, just repeating my delivery and being able to locate.
No thought at all when you got drafted out of high school of signing professionally. I know you were a late round pick, but you had Michigan State there, you know, staring at you. So any wavering there at that point in time?
No, I wasn't. I was too young. I was immature. I wasn't ready for that, I guess you could say. And, you know, I topped when I was in high school. I still hit. So, well, I hit all through Michigan State too. So I wasn't a pitcher per se. Even when the Tigers drafted me out of high school, their comment was, well, we're drafting you as a player, because they didn't know which direction I was going to go. So, but I went from 87, 88 as a senior in high school. I was 6'6", 180, you know, and then after my freshman year of high school, I'm throwing 93, 94, but I weighed 205. Or I'm sorry, my freshman year at Michigan State. So right. And then sophomore year, I'm in the Cape Cod League throwing 96. So, you know, things kind of changed quickly for me. So yeah, being a 50, they don't even go 55 rounds anymore. So
yeah,
it's, that was a pretty deep pick, I guess you could say, at that time. And things changed real quick. Playing in the Cape 2 years later, having agents chasing me to my car and things like that. It was a weird time, because I had no idea what was happening, what was going on. It's not like today where guys have an idea of where they were drafted. I was in the Cape Cod League, and Peter Gammons comes to do a little story on our team. He's like, okay, it'll be on in a few days. And so we're watching ESPN, and it comes on. And at the end of it, he goes, well, Mark Mulder will be one of the top three picks. And I'm with my host family, and I just went, what did he just say? You know, and that's kind of – that was how I was told, wow, I'm going to be picked that high? You know, I had no idea. So obviously things could have changed, but I went back to Michigan State for my junior year, and it kind of just, man, it pushed me. My college pitching coach looked at me and just said, hey, you want to do this? And I was like, yeah, I want to do this. And so we would have our weekend games, and every Monday, whatever my schedule was with classes, I would meet him at the field. Obviously our team had off, and I would meet him at the field, and he would run me through conditioning drills. We would just do things, the two of us, and just to push me that much harder. And no one knew we were doing it. And then Tuesday, obviously, and we had practices and things like that. But that's just why I looked at it as he was such a big part of my success, or helping me get to where I wanted to get to.
He ended up going second overall in the 98 draft to the A's, right behind Pat Burrell. And you were a highly regarded prospect right in the early days of intense coverage of prospects. You mentioned that you didn't really know that you were going to be drafted that high, but nowadays you have the Combine and MLB Network and Baseball America, Baseball Prospectus, MLB Pipeline, and all these outlets that are following high school kids, college kids. What do you think of the kinds of pressures that are being applied now?
Well, I think it kind of can go two ways. You know, some of these kids with social media, with whatever it is, some of these high school, college kids, these guys feel, they kind of feel like they're popular and they're superstars before they've ever done anything, you know, because of the social media. So, but I also think, on the other hand, that can ruin a lot of kids. What that does to you, I could just look at what that would have possibly done to me. Because like I said to you guys, I can look back and say I was very immature, and I was not ready for the type of things that were happening to me as quickly as they did. It's a double-edged sword. I think you also see a lot of these kids, whether it's the high draft picks, whatever, when these kids are getting to the big leagues, they they feel like they belong. I know it was, Coney, I know it was different for your era. It was different for mine. When I got there, I didn't talk. You know, now we had a very young team in Oakland, so it was easier to be louder, and we were all rookies, sort of. But I just remember being very quiet, waiting for some veteran to tell me to go get beer for the bus trip, whatever it was. You know, things are, these kids today, they're arriving, you know, and I think it's all sports. You whatever sport, these kids feel like they belong the second they get there. And that doesn't always equal success. There's plenty of rookies back in the day who had tons of success, but I think it's just different. The social media, the popularity of some of these guys has changed, you know, and maybe some of them, because they're all over the place in high school, maybe that helps them once they're drafted and once they're in the big leagues. Maybe to help, they're able to handle it better. I don't know. I mean, my day, there were definitely some guys, you know, they called them 4A for a reason. They got to the big leagues and they melted. They couldn't handle it. But you put them in the minor leagues and they were studs. So I think it's different for everybody. I don't think that there's still going to be kids like that. It's just different. They just have different things that they're dealing with.
You know, I can't let you get out of here without asking you. I mean, obviously you're part of the big trio. You know, everybody talks about, you know, what are you still in touch with? You know, I mean, it's yeah. Hudson, Zito, and Mulder, right? The big three. Yeah. And then obviously you're part of, you know, in that era, Moneyball comes out, the book Moneyball, and then turns into a movie. And your impressions, you know, I guess a couple of things. Your impressions, did you see the movie Moneyball? Your relationship with Billy Beane, maybe some observations there, you know, in your time there. And do you still keep in touch with the big three guys, with Hudson and Barry?
Yeah, I do keep in touch with them. It's not probably just us three. It's Giambi, Chavez, yeah. Isringhausen, Menachino. We have a group text that there's probably 10 of us that are on it. So including Barry and Huddy. So yeah, I get to talk to these guys all the time. The movie Money, I never read the book. I'm not much of a reader. I thought the movie was great for what it was. If I wasn't really a baseball fan, I would have thought it was a great movie. I enjoyed watching it. There were tons of stuff that was made up, embellished. It's Hollywood. What do you expect? But Billy was awesome to me. I was technically – so Sandy Alderson was still the GM of the A's when I was drafted. And they'd had the Van Poppel situation with the big league deal. Pat Burrell got a big league deal. So at the time, it was like, well, okay, Pat got one. I get one. And so we came to the agreement then that at that time, okay, well, you're not getting a big league deal because we've already done that. They can't let it happen. Well, then Sandy knew he was leaving and Billy was going to take over as general manager. So I was drafted in June. I didn't sign till October. I mean, talk about a miserable summer because I just wanted to go play. And so technically Billy took over. I think I signed 3 days later. So I was Billy's first draft signing, I guess you could say. And I had an unbelievable relationship with Billy. I would pitch poorly. Next day he'd come in the clubhouse, whatever. He'd walk over, sit down next to me with a smirk on his face and be like, what was that? You know, just, and then I'd say something back that, you know, I have kids in the house, so I can't say it, but you know, we had that kind of banter. He could say anything to me and I could say anything to him, and it was awesome. And when he traded me to St. Louis, Tim Hudson got traded a couple of days before me. Billy called me and he goes, hey, we traded you to St. Louis, blah, blah, blah. He goes, I just want you to know I tried to put you in the best possible situation to have success. And he goes, I don't remember what team he said because it was such a blur at the moment when he called. But he mentioned some other team, and I know at that time they were terrible. But his comment was, I could have gotten way better players from so-and-so, but I didn't take them because I wanted to put you in a spot to win. And, you know, so I always appreciated that to this day when we have stuff in Oakland and I see Billy. He's awesome. And I love him to death and appreciate everything from him. And we still joke about how he's not good-looking like they tried to portray him in the movie.
Yeah. Brad
Pitt. We weren't paying for drinks in the clubhouse, things like that. People were always like, "Can you believe they didn't talk about you guys, the pitchers?" That is,
yes.
And I really didn't care one bit, to be perfectly honest. I mean, those were the years we had Corey Lytle as our number four, and we won. I don't know if it was in all of baseball or the American League, but we had four of the top 10 ERAs. You know, Corey Lytle in 2002, I believe, had a 32 inning scoreless streak. Like, it wasn't just the three of us. I mean, we had some really good pitching staffs, 1 through 5. And I mean, that's what, you know, those years made, that's what made it so much fun. We were so young, so talented, but you know, that kind of, that didn't work come playoff time. And that was always unfortunate, because when I got traded to St. Louis, that's when I saw the difference between Oakland and St. Louis. Because when I went to St. Louis, I think we played the Padres in 05 and 06. I think we played them both years. And it was the attitude in the clubhouse was, all right, let's go win these three games and move on to the championship series. And I'm kind of like, huh? You know, I hadn't won a playoff series. So it was really cool being around those guys. And that's where not having the veteran guys who have been there, done that, come playoff time, I thought was a huge thing in St. Louis that we never had in Oakland.
A 2.34 career postseason ERA for you, Mark. 7 starts, no more than 3 earned runs allowed in any of them. So a great postseason career, even if the team success wasn't there in some of those years in Oakland and beyond.
Yeah, it's not a – we all could have pitched better. That's still how I look at it. But you know, when you go to the playoffs, and you know, Oakland's whole, it wasn't necessarily our hitters. It was just the strategy at the time, the walks and homers. You know, that was be patient, take pitches. But the problem is, come playoffs, you're facing all of the best pitchers in the games, so you're not getting those walks. You know, you're not going to hit those 3-run homers that we would during the regular season. So I think that also led to the struggles come playoff time. And that's the difference that I noticed when we got to St. Louis, was guys were coming out hacking on the first pitch, you know, because you're facing the best of the best and you don't want to get deep into counts. You want to get that pitch early in the count. You want to drive it. And I think that was the one thing that probably held us back in the playoffs.
And bullpen too, right? I mean, you look over at the Yankees, they got Mariano Rivera over there.
And you know, we had good closers, but we had a different closer every year. And I believe our closers were winning that Fireman of the Year, I believe, almost 2-3 straight years with Folk or Koch or Isringhausen or whoever we had. I mean, we had some guys that did an incredible job, but to be fair, they never had many save chances come playoff time, because we were losing 2-1, 3-2, whatever it was. So those losses were tough, man, year in, year out. I thought we were a better team. We just weren't ready. We were maybe more talented, maybe not the better team, but we had more talent than some of those teams that we lost to, whether it was Boston, Minnesota. That Yankee loss in 0-1 was hard, I think, for all of us, because getting up 2-0 like that, Huddy and I having game 1 and game 2, it was coming back. I just remember the flight, that none of us were celebrating in any way going back up 2-0 back home. Zito on the mound for game 3, it was just one of those where we had kind of a quiet confidence about us, and Yankee teams were Yankee teams, you know. They found ways to win ball games. And going back for game 5, losing that game, I know we made a couple errors in the first couple innings, and it was just, it was hard. Those were some tough losses.
Where were you watching the Jeter flip play from? And do you remember your initial reaction?
Yeah, I was sitting right there in the dugout. So, you know, some of the stories where they go, oh, they worked on it in spring training. Don't give me that. Like, just stop right now. Because as a player, you could see that play happening. As a shortstop, when a ball's hit down the right field line, you start moving into the infield because you're the second cutoff guy whatever it might be, that throw is generally going to come towards the second baseman. He's going to be in the outfield. And the minute – who is it, Spencer?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the minute Spencer throws that ball, it's airmail. So Jeter is on the grass probably 10 feet from his position – or 10 feet from the pitcher's mound. So he's already creeping in to be a cutoff guy if need be. And the minute that ball is airmailed, he starts running. And we all saw it. You could see it happening. Any shortstop, to be fair, would have done that exact same thing because of the way the throw was made, things like that. But what an unbelievable flip. It almost wasn't believable that normally when a guy is tagged out at home in that way, the guy trips. Lots of times when he's hit with the glove, he falls, he trips, whatever it was. Jeremy never really, his foot never moved. He never slipped. It'd be amazing to see today's game with the replay. What would have come of that with how good the cameras are? I didn't have a, even you watch the video today, you can't tell whether there was a definite tag or there wasn't. I mean, that's how close it was. So, but what people don't realize is Jeremy never should have really been in that position because late in the game, Eric Burns always pinch ran. He was our pseudo pinch runner. And I just don't think it's the one thing I think that maybe Art wasn't expecting at that time. And normally Eric was in that game to pinch run. And so, you know, if he's running, obviously he would have been safe, but you know, but maybe then Terrence doesn't hit that ball. So there's tons of things that go into it, but it's still one of the more memorable moments of Jeter's career.
All right, we can't leave you talking about the 0-1 ALDS. So for the younger viewers, the younger listeners for our podcast, if you could, I guess, think of a behind-the-scenes story, something that happened in the clubhouse with those Moneyball A's teams that just personify that era of what you were going through with the Big Three and the players that you've been mentioning and the talent, the raw talent that was on those teams. Is there one story that comes to mind?
We were young. We were kids. We were really, really talented kids. Our clubhouse was I was only obviously in a few different clubhouses, but it was special, man. We had remote control cars that we'd take out. We'd show up at the field at 1 o'clock and run remote control cars out on the field that were going 60, 70 miles an hour. I mean, it was we would take after games, we would take golf clubs out and hit them over Mount Davis, hit golf balls over Mount Davis. I mean, we were little kids, you know. It was just, we were so close. I mean, when we were on the road, we would go 18 guys of the 25 to dinner because we only had a handful that were married with kids that maybe either didn't want to go or had a family in town or whatever it was. I mean, every road trip we had 15 to 20 guys at dinner. The night we flew in, if we had time to go somewhere, it was such a close knit group of guys, and it didn't matter who those guys were. I mean, Tejada would be up on tables after big wins, dancing with no clothes on. I mean, it was, I mean, the things that happened in that clubhouse were incredible. You know, I mean, we would, our 20 game win streak, We would lose. We lost that. David Justice gave us the one thing I wish they would have put in the movie. David Justice gave a cool speech before the game and just said, "Hey, guys, I've been on a lot of special teams, blah, blah, blah. I've never experienced something like this. Let's enjoy this, blah, blah, blah. Let's go. The whole deal, rah, rah." We go out. We lose. We lose that 21st game, and he comes in and he stands up. He goes, "Guys, I'm never giving another speech again." And we turn on the music. And we acted as if we just won our 25th game in a row. I mean, that's just how it was. It was, we got over things very quick. We had a short memory, kind of like closers. We took things serious when it was time to take it serious. But the rest of the time we were kids and we were enjoying ourselves. We were just a bunch of talented kids that really enjoyed our time together.
left a lot of memories for, I think, you know, guys, James and I's age, like we're in our mid 30s. I mean, we were just getting into high school. You guys were the cool kids. It was awesome to watch. Mark, thanks so much for the time here. I appreciate you giving us a lot of time here on Toeing the Slab. And best of luck. Let's get championship number 4 over in South Lake Tahoe, all right?
I'm going to try. Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
Great. Thanks, Mark.
All right. Thank you.
Guys, Mark brought up a good point. Obviously, they had such great young talent, but I forgot that they pretty much did have a revolving door at closer. I mean, they had Keith Foulke, Billy Koch, Jason Isringhausen. They were elite in that period in Oakland. And that's something that I kind of overlooked there. They had terrific back end of the bullpen.
They did. And, those Yankee series, you know, the Yankees were the dragon that they couldn't quite slay, you know, back then. And it was really the Yankee bullpen that came through big, you know, against Oakland in those close games in that close series that really came through at the end of the games for the Yankees. And, you know, whether it was Mike Stanton or Jeff Nelson or Mariano Rivera on down the stretch, you know, Oakland just could not quite get over the hump. Even though, you know, I would think in the year 2000 and even in 01, Mark's right. I think on paper, the Oakland probably was more talented teams at that point.
Yeah, you're going up against more battle-tested teams, as he alluded to. But you also do get, and it gets, you know, 25 years on now where, you know, we talk about the big sample of the regular season versus the short sample of the postseason. But you get into these series where if you have one team that wins 100 or 95 games, and then there's another team that won 95 or 90 games and they play each other in a 5-game series, it could go either way. The A's lost in the ALDS in game 5 in 2000 and 2001 and 2002 and 2003. So you one bounce of the ball this way or that in any of these games could flip a series, flip a postseason.
Let's get to our Yankees chat here. The Yankees are currently in Oakland. That's where I'm at. And we're recording this the day after they lost the series opener 2-1. The offense still silent against statistically the worst pitching staff in baseball. Yankees are having a really tough time scoring runs. It's lasted throughout the month of June. They scored just under 70 runs in the month so far after totaling 157 in the month of May. And everyone talks about, well, how are you going to fix it? The Yankees are going to be hunting for a big bat near the trade deadline. I'm wondering, can the Yankees even afford a big offensive addition via a trade as we approach the trade deadline?
Well, you got to assume something's out there to be had and there's a match, right? I mean, the problem with the Yankees isn't, you know, at this point, it's not sort of, you know, oh my God, we're really short on outfielders all of a sudden, because Billy McKinney and Jake Bowers have stepped up offensively. And without them, you know, the Yankees would be in much worse shape.
Yeah. The real question.
Yes. The real question is Giancarlo Stanton and Rizzo and, you know, some of the guys that are there, the mainstays, Josh Donaldson, if he's going to get reps at third base, those are the guys that you're looking at that are going to have to come through. You know, there's not much. I mean, you could say Oswaldo Peraza could get called up and be put into the infield mix somewhere, but he's not a savior. He's a great young prospect, a great young player. He will probably eventually get a shot, but he's not the savior. That would be unfair to him. So it's got to be Giancarlo. Giancarlo's got to get it going. We've seen him be real streaky over his career. He's not going anywhere. He's the guy in the absence of Aaron Judge, and we still don't know how long Judge is going to be out. It's Giancarlo. It's got to be Giancarlo. There's no huge bat out there that can be had that you're going to trade for. And who would you have to give up to get him? And I'm not sure the Yankees are in a position to do that. You know, if you got a bat that might fit in, would you trade Peraza? Would you trade Jason Dominguez? Would you trade your top prospects? You know, Austin Wells, the top catching prospect, a left-handed bat. You really want to give those guys up for, you know, for a chance to land one more big bat, depending on how long Aaron Judge is out? I'm not sure that's the answer.
Who would that even be?
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's what these struggles are forcing them to contemplate.
Right. Last year, Juan Soto was out there, and even that was more of a pie in the sky sort of thing. And the Padres pulled it off, you know, with a richer farm system. You know, the general consensus that the Yankees weren't going to be able to match a package that they could have put together for something like that. And that's why the trade market is always way harder to navigate than free agency, because you have to make sure that your minor leaguers match up with that team or that team, and make sure that you can make these decisions on the fly. But for the offense, it's going to come down to the guys that were here for the last few years, where the Yankees led the American League and run scored last year. And as much as they were mocked for running it back, they did it for a reason, because they're built around Aaron Judge, Giancarlo Stanton, Anthony Rizzo, DJ LeMahieu, guys who have had a lot of success, have had a lot of success recently, but just not now while Judge is injured.
That's what makes a Yankee fan nervous, because this is a prolonged stretch of struggles for some of these guys in the lineup. I'm watching it game in and game out. There are so many like high stress pitches being thrown from this pitching staff for the Yankees that's excelled, but I'm wondering how much fatigue could the offensive struggles put on the pitchers as a whole? Can this last where they're continually effective in these high stress situations?
It can wear on you, but as you guys mentioned before, there's help on the way. Carlos Rodon's on the way. Nestor Cortez will eventually come back. Ian Hamilton probably will be there tonight, as soon as tonight and for tonight's game. So they have the overall depth to sort of withstand this sort of offensive struggle as we see it. I almost feel like you got to go the other way. You got to go run prevention. You got to go really good defense. Maybe if you found a really good defensive outfielder out there that you could get into the games if you do get that one-run lead along the way. I mean, to me, I'm thinking run prevention. Build around this offensive build around the depth of the pitching staff and the reinforcements that are coming, but really put an emphasis on defense. And, you know, whether that's, you know, somebody you can find off the scrap heap or somebody that's a really good defender in the outfield, you know, that might be somebody you could add. That could really help, you know, on down the stretch there, especially if you get a lead late in the games. You could spell maybe Jake Bowers, who's in left field or right field while Aaron Judge is out. You know, you got Harrison Bader in center field. Billy McKinney's a pretty good outfielder. He can play all three outfield spots, probably, you know, at a minimum average in terms of the metrics so far. So maybe another really good defender in the outfield and go for run prevention would be my sort of, you know, just on the fringes, something I'd be looking for.
I like that idea. I'm not worried about the staff holding up, even though there aren't a lot of tight games, because they've been able to spread the workload out very well. And Coney mentioned the reinforcements that are coming. But in the bigger picture, yes, when you are struggling to score runs like this, you are in lower scoring games, which means the leverage is going to be higher. They're not going to be these laughers where, you know, you're up 10-3 and you can use some of your lower rung levers. You are leaning on guys more often in this stretch since Judge went down. So starting with that last Dodger game after he went down. So start since June 4th, 19 games for the Yankees, 16 of them have been decided by 3 runs or fewer, 13 of them by 2 runs or fewer. Every game has been tight because with lower scoring, there's less variance between scores and everything's going to be 3-2, 2-1, 4-2.
Yeah. You know, for all the flack that fans may have for Aaron Boone, I think he and Matt Blake and Desi Drewshall, they have done a masterful job managing the bullpen's workload. Go back and take a look at some box scores. You'll see the you know, maybe the top 3-4 relievers who maybe get some run on consecutive nights, or, you know, potentially 2 out of 3. And maybe not limit to those top 3 relievers. It's pretty much everyone. No one's really thrown more than maybe 15 pitches an outing. There are some outings where guys are going back to back. They're throwing like 8-9 pitches in each game. And that's how this will continue to work. So hats off to Matt Blake, to Desi Drewshall, and obviously Aaron Boone for managing the bullpen the way they have. It's a big reason why they, you know, are statistically at the top in a lot of bullpen categories here.
That's going to make light work.
Yeah, it takes a village, right? You need to use everybody down there. Yeah.
That is going to do it for this week, guys. Appreciate you tuning in. Thanks to Mark Mulder for joining us as well to look back on some terrific years in Oakland and St. Louis, and looking ahead to a pretty big celebrity golf tournament. You got like Patrick Mahomes and Josh Allen. There's some new blood in this celebrity golf tournament as well that Mark Mulder and the like have to worry about. James, David, always a pleasure. We will talk to you next week. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. And, of course, for our terrific producer, Dan Rourke, we will catch you next week here on Toe in the Slab, Pitching with David Cone, a production of John Boy Media. Take care, everybody.